அன்னை அன்பர்கள் அனைவருக்கும் வணக்கம். ஸ்ரீ அன்னை பகவான் ஸ்ரீ அரவிந்தர் அப்பா தவத்திரு கர்மயோகி அவர்களின் பாதார விந்தங்களில் பணிந்து இன்றைய லைஃப் டிவை நிகழ்ச்சியை துவங்குகிறோம். இன்று மிஸ்டர் கேரி சார் அவர்களும் மிஸ்டர் சந்திரசேகரன் அவர்களும் பேச இருக்கிறார்கள். இன்றைய டாபிக் நாஸ்டிக் பீயிங். இது வந்து பார்ட் டூல வந்து புக் டூல பார்ட் டூ 27th சாப்டர் லைஃப் டிவைனோட எண்டுக்கு அந்த புஸ்தகம் முடியற இடத்துக்கு நம்ம வந்துட்டோம். பீப்புள் கேன் என்ஜாய் திஸ் ஸ்பீச். ஐ எம் இன்வைட்டிங் மிஸ்டர் கேரி டு ஸ்டார்ட் தி டாபிக்.
குட் ஆஃப்டர்நூன். ஹவ் மெனி ஆஃப் யூ நோ தி நர்சரி ரைம் அபௌட் ஹம்ப்டி டம்ப்டி? 1, 2, 3. ஹவ் மெனி? ஹம்ப்டி டம்ப்டி. நாட் எவ்ரிபடி. Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall, Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses, all the king's men could not put Humpty Dumpty together again, no? Somehow that came to me about 3 days ago. Just silly thing, I never thought about it in my life. But then I realized, I don't know why they, what they meant by it, but I realized that it's a good analogy for us, for what has happened in the creation of the world, because we are the spirit which has fallen and broken into, shattered into a million pieces, and we're trying to come back together again. And certainly kings and kings' men and horses can't put us back together again. Then I thought of the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, which Sri Aurobindo specifically mentions in the first paragraph of the chapter on ego and the dualities. He refers to the story and says, "This is the story of the soul tempted by nature into divided being. Purusha is tempted by Prakriti into divided being, into a world of dualities. The whole key to the world is that spirit and nature have become separate from one another. So Purusha and Prakriti have become separate and almost independent of one another, and even in the Indian tradition, that's how it's thought. Prakriti is nature, Purusha is the silent witness being. And the whole story of the ascent back to supermind is the story of the reunification of spirit and nature. Because if we're talking about divine life, what is divine life? Nature must become divine. Nature can only become divine when we recover the spirit in nature. He says when nature becomes supernature. And he gives that formula in the chapter on ego and dualities. He says this fall, what the Bible called a fall, a sin, the original fall of man into ignorance, tempted by the Prakriti. This can only be overcome when the individual soul becomes universalized, when the ego, when we lose the ego and become universal, and when we recover the spiritual term in the physical. That's what he says, meaning what's the physical is matter. Only when we recover the, discover the fact that matter is Brahman, we can overcome the fall. So this is not an ordinary thing. The whole book is leading up to, he's described in book 2, part 1, he's described Humpty Dumpty having a fall and breaking up into a million pieces, which he calls the ignorance, very politely calls it the ignorance. And book 2, part 2 is spiritual evolution, the knowledge and spiritual evolution leading back to unity. not a unity in super conscient, a unity in the world, a unity in life, where spirit is not going away from life in order to find peace and quiet and happiness. Spirit is manifesting in life. A few days ago, we had a meeting in Pondi with staff. Ranjani was there, Janani, Vani, Shweta, and others. Vasugi, whose birthday, her birthday today. And we were discussing this chapter, and somehow, I don't remember why, I thought about my aunt. Maybe I'd mentioned her sometime in our meetings. She came at the age of 65 to Pondi. She met Mother and stayed and spent the rest of her life in Pondi. When my aunt was growing up, she was not a very, she was a difficult person, let's say that way. And my father used to tell stories about her, and one story came back to my mind. I don't know why, but I thought of sharing it with you. When my father was about 6 years old, he was in his room, he was making a giant jigsaw puzzle with small pieces that fit in together. The jigsaw puzzle usually has a picture on one side. But you get it in a box with thousands of pieces. This is not a small jigsaw puzzle. This jigsaw puzzle was maybe the size of Sri Aurobindo and Mother's photo here, or bigger, maybe half the size of this screen. So it had to be made on the floor. And he was working on it for about 7 or 10 days, trying to piece together thousands of small little pieces. He was getting toward the end after working for about 10 days on this, where he had maybe 50 pieces left to put in. And my aunt ran in the room, ran right across the room, right through the middle of the puzzle, and completely spilled it over. So when I thought of this, I thought of Adam and Eve. It was Eve who was tempted Adam into divided being. My aunt divided up everything that was trying to become whole. And my father was so angry, he fought with her, and that's another story. So I thought about the jigsaw puzzle. Imagine that life is a jigsaw puzzle. And we are trying to put it back together. We're trying to assemble the jigsaw puzzle and piece everything together. And if you think about it, when you start, when you see a pile of all of these pieces together, you don't say, usually when you buy a jigsaw puzzle, you have a picture on the box that tells you what the final picture is. And you're that gives you a hint. So you try to look for a way to assemble something that looks like the picture on the box. But supposing there's no picture on the box. Supposing you have 2,000 pieces of the puzzle, but you don't know what the picture is. That's our problem. We're in life, we're trying to assemble something, but we don't know what it is. We don't know what the puzzle is. We don't know what it is we're trying to assemble. So if you don't know what it is you're trying to assemble, you try to find pieces that are related to each other, simple pieces that fit together, simple pieces that seem to match each other in color, and you, little by little, you try to piece together a small part of the puzzle. So if we don't have a picture, it's much more difficult. Now, supposing there's no picture, but we're blind. We're blind. The man who's trying to assemble the puzzle is blind. He doesn't have a picture. He can't even see the shapes. He has to take the shapes and feel and try to find something that goes with something else and piece it together. For us, for human consciousness in mind, We are in the ignorance. The ignorance is we don't know the purpose of life. We don't know the truth of life. We don't know how everything is connected to everything else. We don't even know what's the picture that's supposed to come. When Darcy comes to Meriden, he doesn't know why he has come to Meriden. He went there to go hunting and with Bingley. When Bingley comes up to him at the dance and says, hey, why don't you dance with Elizabeth Bennett? She's a nice-looking girl. He takes a look at her. The first thing he thinks is nobody's dancing with her. If no other man is dancing with her, what happens to my prestige if I dance with her? If she was really pretty, other people would be dancing with her. I don't want to dance with her. This is his soulmate. This is the purpose of his life, but he doesn't know the picture. He's not seen the picture on the, he doesn't know that his life is to lead to marriage with Elizabeth Bennet. So even when life leads him towards her, he says, no, she's tolerable. And he insults her. And 3 months later, when he figures out the mistake he's made and he goes and proposes to her, and he says, I made a mistake. I want to marry you in spite of your low connections and all of that. She says, you're the last man on earth I would ever marry. Last man on earth I would ever marry. So what's her position? She's equally blind. Are we any better? Do we know what's supposed to happen in our life? Do we know what we're born for? Do we know? We know what society tells us. Society gives us some map. But I'm talking spiritually. Do we know what our life is supposed to be? None of us were born with the idea we must come to mother. We must discover her somehow. Like blind men, just going around with our eyes closed, we stumble on something and somehow it happens, like Darcy met Elizabeth and finally she met him again at Pemberley and all. This is the mind. This is rather the mental consciousness. This is our position. We've been evolving for millions of years in order to become blind men. So life to us looks something like this. It looks something like a big bundle pile of jigsaw pieces, and we don't know what fits with anything else. When Lizzie meets Wickham the first time, she says, look how handsome he is. He's got a red coat. He's a soldier. He's an officer. He's so handsome, he must be a good man. And he's very polite, he's very charming. I like talking to him. Maybe I should spend my life with him. Not that horrible man, Darcy. She's completely blind. She's going in the other direction. She's trying to put a square peg in a round hole. It's a wonder if any jigsaw puzzle is ever assembled. This is what he means by ignorance. When he talks about ignorance, he's talking about our lives are a jigsaw puzzle. And with blinders on our head, without having a picture of the map, we're trying to put it all together. What is he saying to us? He's saying this is the picture. Divine life. Harmony, delight of existence, beauty, love, and joy is there. That's what's waiting for you. Open your eyes. Come out, take your head out of the hole in the ground and see the reality. Life is divine and will be divine when you come out of the ignorance. And that's what he's offering us. We don't see this. We see the bundle of jigsaw pieces. And we don't know what it's trying to say to us, what it's trying to make, and we don't know how to fit everything. So each time you meet a new person, you have to ask yourself, is it a good person or a bad person? Is it somebody I should help or somebody I should avoid? If I get invited to this place, should I go or not to go? Each moment, we don't know what we're supposed to be doing. We have to make decisions, but we're in the ignorance. We don't know how to do it. We don't know how to relate in order to convert this pile of jigsaw puzzle pieces into a beautiful picture. This is only an analogy, of course, and it's a very simplified, oversimplified analogy, because this is only an analogy in two dimensions of space. A jigsaw puzzle is a flat object on the ground. It's not a living thing. It's not even three-dimensional. It's only a picture. Imagine instead of a two-dimensional jigsaw puzzle that there's a huge crystal, piece of crystal. I'm not going to tell you what it is because I can't see it. But supposing this picture is converted into a three-dimensional gem of magnificent splendor, the only thing is it's shattered in a million pieces. The problem is much more difficult, because in the jigsaw puzzle, all you have to do is match things, what goes on this side, what goes on that side, what goes on this side, what goes on that side. But in a three-dimensional object, each piece has to fit with everything around it in all dimensions. It's three-dimensional.
Sir, Janani has a question. You spoke about the ignorance of Elizabeth. Are we not in double ignorance? Because first of all, we do not even know we are in an ignorance. Then the next stage is to know what that ignorance is and then get out of it.
Actually, we're not in double ignorance. We are in double ignorance, but he's already told us that we're in seven times ignorance. Our ignorance is much greater. All the ignorance I'm talking about is the practical ignorance. We don't know what to do the next minute. We are in a practical ignorance, a constitutional ignorance, a psychological ignorance, a temporal ignorance, an egoistic ignorance, a cosmic ignorance, an original ignorance. So definitely, it's many, many times double ignorance. That's why I say it's only an analogy. So I gave the idea of the crystal object because much more difficult to figure it out, but still it's very too much simplified. Our situation is much more complex because this is only an ignorance in space, but we live in time. So I thought, imagine an orchestra. I know orchestra is not an Indian proposition. I'm talking about a Western orchestra, which may have about 100 musicians of all so many different instruments, the string instruments, the drums, all the different, I forget what you call them, the percussion instruments, then there's the trumpet and the trombones and all of those things. Maybe 40 different, the violins, the cellos, and maybe 30, 40 different types of instruments. Now, supposing 100 musicians are invited to come to train for a performance or give a performance, but the conductor of the performance doesn't show up, and none of the musicians are told what it is they're supposed to perform. And they each will do what we would do in that situation, what we're doing every day. We're each testing and using our own instrument. We're each playing our own music. And it has nothing to do with what everybody else is playing. And there's only by chance there may be some harmony with it. And if I hear somebody else playing something that I know, I start playing that, but other people are playing something else and they're competing, we're competing with each other. No, no, not this, you should be playing that. Because we are all blind and we don't know what we're here for. We have the capacity to make not only a beautiful garden, but a beautiful symphony. But we don't know what the symphony is. And we don't have anybody to instruct us and guide us in that symphony. The supermind is the conductor. The score, the music that tells each of the, remember, 100 musicians, each one is supposed to be playing a different part. Some louder, some softer, some faster, some slower, some at a higher octave, some at a lower octave, some quiet, then starting, then stopping. It's a rhythm and movement in space and time. What tells them what to play and when to play? So when he talks about the Gnostic being or the Gnostic consciousness, which is the chapter, this is the chapter, he's talking about the consciousness that would tell every musician at every minute what part they should be playing, so that each musician would be in harmony with all the other musicians. You follow? Each one would be playing a different part, not all the same. It's not that we're all singing the same song and that exactly the, each musician is playing a different part, but all are in harmony. Even a conductor can't do that. Everybody must know their part in the universal symphony. That's the Gnostic consciousness. Our problem is we've been brought into the theater, we've got an instrument, and we don't know what we're supposed to play, and we don't know what everybody else is playing, and sometimes it creates terrible noise in the head, and occasionally it comes out nicely for a few minutes. The whole world is like that, our whole life is like that. We are here to play a magnificent symphony, but mostly what we're generating is noise, irritation, friction, confusion. Sometimes we just want to stop and cover our ears, enough of this, because nothing is coming out the way it should. This is the ignorance. That's the gnosis. That's what he's talking about in this chapter. He's talking about, at least we have instruments, at least we can play. Before there was mind, when the animal was there, when the plant was there, there's no instrument, there's no capacity to play. Now we have a capacity to play, but we don't know what to play. And even if we know what to play, we want everybody to play our music the way we want to do it, and everybody's playing a different music. And we have no control over everybody. We say everybody should believe what we believe. Everybody should do what we say. That's what Mrs. Bennett wants. And most people, that's what the ego wants. We want everybody, we'll be the conductor, and everybody else should be just obediently doing it. And everybody wants to be the conductor. If everybody wants to be the conductor, how can you have a symphony? Everybody must follow the same harmony. The harmony is the gnosis. To know that harmony at each moment, to know the truth, not just the truth for you, but the truth for you and the truth for every other person, the truth for the divine, that's the Gnostic consciousness which he's talking about in this chapter. But still, my analogy is not a very good analogy. It's very incomplete. We're talking about space, and now we're talking about time. But we're talking about conscious human beings. We are not just having instruments. We're having many qualities. Lizzie is cheerful, energetic, courageous, somewhat independent. Jane is sweet, mild, a little foolish, not very strong. Darcy's a good man, but he's proud, a little arrogant, a little rough. Wickham is very handsome, very charming, but completely unreliable, and you can't believe a word he says. So we are a mixture of qualities. And each of these qualities is interacting with each other and with the qualities of everybody else. But the truth is, before Humpty Dumpty fell down from the wall, all of these qualities were parts of the divine consciousness. They all come from Satchidananda. The peace, the silence, infinity, eternity, truth, goodness, knowledge, power, love, beauty, joy, faith, courage, all the spiritual qualities are not separate things. They're all expressions of the spiritual consciousness. But look at what we have. We each get a little of one, a little of another, all mixed together in different proportions, some positive, some negative, completely a mixture of sambar, rasam, and some kind of a sweet, and something else, all these ingredients mixed together in confusion. And each of us is like that, and we're trying to figure out how to relate to one another. So, the man she's meant for comes to her, and he's proud. And his pride just gets in the way. His arrogance, his sense of self-importance get in the way. Immediately in response to that, her prejudice comes up. And her strength comes up, and she gets offended by him, and she wants to strike back. He's insulted me, I will put him down. And she finally has a wonderful opportunity when he proposes to her. And she says, it's been since the time I met you, I have decided you're such a selfish, mean, arrogant person. You're the last man I would ever marry. She feels a great satisfaction in being able to abuse him, because we are a bundle of different qualities. All of them are divine when they're unified. But when they're broken up into tiny little pieces, all of them become ignorant and separate from one another. That's the dualities. They lose their divinity, they lose their harmony, and they become a source of conflict. So our problem is much greater. So what's the analogy for that, I thought? Supposing instead of 100 musicians, we have 100 actors. Or leave alone the 100 actors, we are all here. We're about 25, 30 of us now. Supposing we all are invited to a play, right, to a theater, to act in a play. Only thing is, we're not told what the play is. And we're not told which parts we're supposed to play. But the moment the curtain opens, we have to start acting. We don't know whether this is a tragedy or a comedy. We don't know whether you don't know whether you're a hero or the devil. You don't know whether you're a good girl or a bad girl or anything else. But we have to start acting. And we don't know who's our friend and who's our enemy. We don't know. And this is really what the ignorance is all about. Our problem is not just with everything that's going on around us. We don't know who we are. And even if we have different qualities, we don't know which quality we should be expressing. Even in our best attempts to be in harmony with others, we don't know how to do it. Okay, we can be a little harmonious here, but like in the jigsaw puzzle, you get one piece to fit in, but it doesn't fit in with anything else. We're totally out of harmony. This is the ignorance. Now imagine, without a script, without a director, you get on, we all come into the room, we spontaneously begin to act in such a way as to bring out a beautiful story with joy and harmony and creative delight. And with each character, when we relate to them, we spontaneously and instinctively know how we should relate to them to bring out the truth and the best in them and the best in us, to bring out the truth, to bring out the joy, to bring out the creativity. It would be a spontaneous creation of consciousness, of beauty, love, and joy, of the delight or ananda of existence. This is the Gnostic consciousness. So how far we are being where we are from that consciousness, and how different life will be when we get in this consciousness, that's the purpose of these analogies. Now, he tells us in this chapter, in the very first paragraph of this chapter, up until now, we've been discussing things that are very difficult to understand, but it's possible. Mind can at least imagine what the higher mind is, because the higher mind is when thought falls silent. And instead of the thoughts in the ignorance, there are thoughts that come from the truth that come in the higher mind in its silence. All right, I'm not sure I've had a truth thought, but I can imagine something. And then he goes beyond that to the illumined mind, where there'll be a vision of something true. And then the intuitive mind, where we get an intuitions of the truth. We see something and instinctively we know the truth about it. The way Ramanujam knew the answers to his theorems, the mathematical theorems that he wrote. But he says, we have a problem now when we come to supermind. The difference between mind and supermind is so great that it's almost, I think he says almost, it's almost impossible for the mental consciousness to understand what the supermental consciousness is. But he's written a chapter about it. And he's writing a chapter to our mind. And we're trying to understand what supermind is using the mind. When he's told us to begin with, it's almost impossible for mind to understand supermind because it's the wrong faculty. Let's just say, he says, that though you cannot have the knowledge of supermind, because it's a totally different, as the analogies show, it's a totally different way of looking and knowing reality, we can have some approximations to it. We can say some things about it. We can give some principles of it, which will help us imagine what it is. We can never definitely not know it, but we can understand something about it much more than we do. But in order to do that, we first have to understand what's the difference between mind and supermind. And so he starts the chapter, after telling us it's a nearly impossible task, he explains why. He says it's nearly impossible because mind sees only finite things. Mind is an instrument for division, which we've talked about many times. It takes the reality and cuts it up into an infinite number of pieces. That's like the puzzle which my aunt blasted across the store, the crystal sphere that's broken into a million pieces. That's what mind does. The sphere is reality. And what is that reality? The rishis discovered it. It's an infinite consciousness, an infinite existence, an infinite bliss. That is the reality. There's only one reality. Everything else is not reality. The reality is an infinite existence, consciousness, bliss. It's infinite. Mind cannot see infinity. Mind cannot know infinity. Mind takes it breaks it up, throws it on the ground, gets it in a million pieces, and starts investigating each little piece to try to understand what the reality is. It can't see that whole. So it starts with the part. So we have to understand what the mental consciousness is. And he says, the difficulty of mind, let's be practical about it. There are several ways in which we have a problem knowing reality. He says, first of all, mind knows only the data that we collect. You remember, I think in the last meeting, I told that Sherlock Holmes story about Silver Blaze. The horse was stolen. Didn't we talk about it in one of the stories? No? Okay. It's one of the Sherlock Holmes. I'm sure we know. Okay. Doesn't matter. A famous racehorse is stolen. And the trainer of the racehorse is found dead near the training grounds. And the police come and gather all of the evidence, and they come to the conclusion that there was a man who was coming and inquiring about the horse, because the next day is to be a very famous race, a very big race with a very big prize, and this horse was supposed to be the winner of the race. And now the horse is missing, and the trainer of the horse is dead. And a few hours before this happened, a man came from London inquiring about the horse and how's the health of the horse and everything. And the police found that man is staying at a nearby inn, and they found the man's kerchief, his scarf, near the dead body of the trainer. And they pieced together what happened, and it turns out the police theory was that this man was a gambler, and he wanted to make sure that this horse doesn't win the race. So he came to steal the horse. So what he did was he went up to the barn where the horse was being kept in a locked place, and with a boy inside to protect the horse because he's worth £1 million or £100,000. And the man put some opium in the food of the boy. So when the boy had his dinner, he fell into a deep coma. And when the boy was sleeping, the man broke into the stable, took the horse, and went out. And the police assumed, they concluded, the trainer must have heard something or gotten suspicious, and he must have run down from his house to find out. And when he found this man stealing the horse, the man killed the trainer and took the horse away. Now the race is going to happen the next day. The horse, nobody knows where the horse is. They found the man. He's sleeping nicely in a hotel nearby. And when they come, and he claims he's innocent, and they arrest him, and they feel the case is open and shut case, except that the horse is still missing and they don't know what happened to the horse. Sherlock Holmes hears all of the things. He sees all of the data that they see, but says something wrong here. See, how come the boy who took the dinner didn't taste the opium? Opium has a strong taste. It turns out that he didn't taste the opium because that night they had mutton curry. And because of the curry spices in the food, he couldn't taste the opium. So the boy ate the dinner and went to sleep. But that raises a question. How did this man coming from London know that they were going to serve mutton curry that night, so nicely arranged so that he could put the opium in it? and do this. Of course, the police have already solved the case, so they're not worried about what was served for dinner. That's all trivial, silly things. So Holmes says, is there any other possible explanation for the facts? Supposing that the mutton curry was intentionally prepared so that the opium could be put in it and it won't be tasted by the man, by the boy. Who could have done that? It could only have been somebody from the house where the food was prepared, which was the trainer's house. Well, the police are sure that the trainer was the victim, but he says, supposing the trainer wasn't the victim, supposing the trainer has put the opium in the mutton curry, which he sent down to the boy so the boy would sleep so that the trainer could steal his horse. Why would the trainer steal his own horse? What's the purpose in that? And then who killed the trainer? It doesn't make sense. He said, supposing the trainer wasn't trying to steal the horse, supposing the trainer was trying to do something in the middle of the night that would make the horse lose the race. And the trainer, when he died, he had a small knife in his hand, like a surgical knife in his hand. And it cut him. What could he possibly have been doing with this knife? Why would the trainer want his own horse to lose? If the trainer thought his horse is the favorite, if his trainer knew the horse was going to lose, he can bet against the horse and earn much more money than he can earn by betting for the horse, because everybody thinks this horse is going to win. So maybe the trainer was trying to do something to the horse to be sure that he wouldn't win the race. And he went and took him out of the stable, took him out onto the hills where he couldn't be heard, and he was trying to use this knife to cut into the back of the foot of the horse, a small little injury which wouldn't be visible, but would prevent the horse from running. It's all very interesting and all, but who killed the trainer? And he goes on and on thinking, and it finally says, when the trainer tries to stick the knife into the horse like naturally would react and kick its feet, the horse killed the trainer. So our problem, and that turns out to be the fact, and the horse ran away and they found him somewhere else, and then many other facts. But the point is, our mind, reality is so complex. There are so many things going on. So you have all come this afternoon, I have come this afternoon, we're talking, but how much do I know about all the lives that you have gone through to come here? How much do you know about all the preparation we have done here and others in order to get here? We know only a few of the facts. The complexity, we don't know why some people who come are not here. What happened? We don't know. Life is so complex. There are so many facts. When Wickham tells Lizzie that he was granted by old Darcy the living, to be given a living for £2,000 or £1,000, and Darcy took it away. He was the godson of old Darcy. His father was the steward at Pemberley, all of which is true. Old Darcy wanted to give him a living. All of this is true. But that's not the only truth. It's also true that he went and told Darcy he doesn't want to be a clergyman. He doesn't want that living. He asked him to give him a few thousand pounds so he could go and be a lawyer. He forgot to tell Lizzie that. It's also true that he took that money and squandered it and never finished his law degree. He didn't tell Lizzie that. It's also true that he came back a year later and he tried to elope with Georgiana. All of that he didn't say. There's so much complexity in life, mind sees only a little bit of the story. In fact, if we decided before we start our afternoon discussion, let's all of us tell our story of how we came here this afternoon. I may have to tell you what we've been doing for the last 1 month in preparation. Each of you will have your own story. And if somebody hasn't come, they would have their, we would spend the whole afternoon and maybe even tomorrow just talking about how we got here. We would never get to, because the complexity of the facts, sometimes very relevant facts. I told you, and I thought about the crossword, suddenly I thought about my aunt for a story that happened about 70 years ago, maybe 80 years, no, 100 years ago. Somehow it connected to me with Adam and Eve. The life is so complex. Mind sees only a little part of reality. It does not see the whole. It does not know the whole. The whole reality is infinite. The Gnostic consciousness is a consciousness of the infinite. Consciousness of the infinite doesn't mean that it sees all the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle, because there are millions and millions and millions of pieces of the jigsaw puzzle. Consciousness of the infinite means at each moment it sees the truth that's relevant at that moment. For Sherlock Holmes, the key to the whole thing was, how was it that the opium was put into mutton curry? How lucky the murderer was that they prepared mutton curry that night. He understood the whole truth was there in that single fact, which to the police was totally irrelevant. I think I've mentioned this when Sri Aurobindo was first in Pandi, maybe around 1920, 22, something like that. A Supreme Court lawyer named Ordasamy came to him, very famous lawyer, met him, and said he has a very important case, and he wants to consult Sri Aurobindo on the case. You remember the story? He gives the paper to Sri Aurobindo, and Sri Aurobindo sees a light. He points one place. He sees a light coming there at that place. He points, here, you look here. And the man went back and won the case, and he came back and offered Sri Aurobindo a lakh of rupees. A lakh of rupees 100 years ago, 90 years ago. What was it worth? It's crores. Sri Aurobindo said, I can't take your money. The man was pleading. Mother finally said, we'll take 10 lakhs out of it. We take 10,000 rupees. We can't take more than that. It's not that Sri Aurobindo studied all of these papers. He didn't spend 3 weeks studying these papers of this huge case with all the evidence. He went to the truth of it, which showed him as a light. That is the Gnostic consciousness. So imagine if Sherlock Holmes is a Gnostic being, when the case is brought to him, and he doesn't even have to come to the place where the theft or the murder took place, even in London in his house, when the inspector comes and says, we have a difficult case, and he asks, what did the boy have for dinner? Looks very silly. I told you the boy is dead, and the man is dead, and the racehorse is missing, and we have a panic, and we've got a murder on our hands, and you're asking, what did the boy who was sleeping have for dinner? How silly. Because he sees the light there, the truth of the whole thing is hidden behind the mutton curry. At every minute, wouldn't it be great? So when Bingley comes up to Darcy and says, come on, Darcy, don't be standing there being stupid. You should also dance. There are so many pretty girls here. Why don't you dance with Elizabeth Bennet? She's tolerable. Imagine if he has the truth consciousness. The moment he looks at Elizabeth Bennet, it's not her pretty face. It's not the fact that she's dancing or not dancing. He will see, of course, whether he sees with his eyes or he sees with his heart or he sees with his soul, he will see, oh, this is my destiny. My destiny is here. That's what happened to Savitri. For 1 year, she's been traveling around looking. She's been sent out because no proposals are coming, not because she's not a desirable or eligible bride, because she's so divine that everybody's afraid to even give a proposal to her. So her father, Aswapati, sends her out for 1 year. She goes from all the kingdoms. She goes to the forest. She goes and sits with the rishi. She goes into all the courts. She talks and she goes and sees the whole of Bharat. And finally, when she's riding past a forest, she sees a woodsman just coming out. She looks away, and then she looks back, and suddenly she has the truth vision. She knows, this is the man I've been looking for 1 year. She knows not with her eyes, not because he was handsome. She knows with the Gnostic consciousness in her. Imagine if at each moment of our life, in each situation, should I do this, should I do that? Should I do it, should I say this or not say that? Usually we shouldn't say it, that we know, that's the easy answer. We probably shouldn't say most things. What should we do, what should we say, where should we go, what should we think, what should we feel, what should we understand? Imagine if we had that consciousness at each moment that instinctively tells us, not because we're calculating, not because we're remembering the rules from, what did he say in chapter 27 or chapter 29? What is the principles of psychic education? Not because we've memorized 100 rules, not because we've read all of Appa's books and memorized them. Vasanta Mami has read one of Appa's books, I think, 1,000 times. over and because we live in the truth. What is that truth? That truth is not a formula. That truth is not a chapter of life divine. That truth is the right way to relate to each person at each moment in every situation. It's not one truth. It's the symphony. It's to be in harmony with the divine will. It's to be in harmony with the evolving life. You're asking, why is this chapter in the evolution part of the book and not in the involution part of the book? Is it because the Gnostic consciousness is to be realized in the evolution? That's your question. It's a good question. The Gnostic consciousness, we are in the penultimate chapter. The next chapter, the last chapter, is the divine life. It's the culmination of the evolution, but not the end. He tells us that. It's not the end. We'll discuss it again. But we have been evolving for thousands, millions of years, more than millions of years, and this is the next stage in the evolution. This is not the stage from mind to higher mind. We're going through that. This is, stage means, the first stage was matter. The second stage was life. The vegetal life, the lower animal life. The third stage of the evolution is mind, which started in the animal or even in the plant and has gradually come to the human level and goes all the way up to overmind. We're not finished with mind yet. But he's talking about the next stage, which is the supramental stage of evolution. And Mother has said, I think I've mentioned it, the distance between man and Superman in an evolutionary sense, in a consciousness sense, is greater than the difference between man and the ape in the forest. We're not talking about the next step. We're talking about another world. But that world is inevitable. That path is inevitable. So the answer, the direct answer to your question is, we're talking about where we are going. We're talking about the map. Appa has described it this way. He said, life divine is the horoscope of the universe. if you take horoscope in the most positive sense, maybe more than it is, the thing that tells you, if imagine there was a horoscope that could tell you at every moment from now until eternity where what you should do, what you should think, what you should feel in order to grow into the truth of your destiny, Life Divine does it not for the individual. Life does it for the whole universe. It tells us what is the destiny. It tells us what is the direction. It tells us how to get there, how to move, thank you, in order to get there. So this is the evolution. And of course, their purpose is because the more we understand where we are, the purpose is not to humiliate us and make us feel blind. And the purpose is the more we understand what our destiny is, the more conscious we become and the more we can accelerate this process of evolution. So Sri Aurobindo has said, if man ever understood, even for a minute, what's waiting, what is our future destiny, if he ever, it's a long list, beautiful, I can't repeat it, if he ever had any idea of the freedom, the joy, the knowledge, the power, the delight in, the beauty, the grace, the harmony, it's a long, beautiful list that's waiting for us, he would drop everything and rush to the future. Right now, we're trying to collect so many things and hold on to them. We're collecting at our level rather than dropping everything and rushing to the future. This is to give us a hint of what that is.
When you mentioned that prayer, between when I asked you, I have to talk to you for 5 minutes. When you told us to do the prayer, you can talk. 3 seconds, you went on. And I closed my eyes and started my prayer. Then a big sound of blades, some flower they put and the blades made it go up. Immediately, so this is telling something for me. And now I have to stop this thought. And I continued to pray. Within 5 minutes, I went upstairs. And the problem was solved. The contradiction became complementary. And I have to solve the problem there. And they re-asked the question and I answered it. And contradiction became complementary. And when I came down, I told you because the solution has come. When you also told, it's better that this is what I also thought about.
Exactly what I felt.
Yes.
When you asked, I said it will be better if you don't
tell
me.
Yes. Immediately, the song down came and I became aware of that. And you see, it is connected with this. That's what
you're supposed to do. It's exactly. Is this connected with that?
Exactly connected with this because this, on page 330, he says, the infinite is expressing itself at every moment in the determinations of the finite. Everything we call finite is only an appearance. The real truth of it, the real significance of it, is not in the surface, it's behind. Appa has been quoting very recently from Savitri that line. He must be writing it also in his recent writings. And squanders eternity on a beat of time. It's a line from the first canto of Savitri during the dawn. The eternal squanders eternity. It puts all of eternity into each moment of time. We only hear see the moment. It's here, it's gone. We miss the significance. Sri Aurobindo says it. The infinitesimal is the infinite. The infinite is not just the very big. The infinite is there behind every infinitesimal detail. The path to the infinite is not there. The path to the infinite is here in each moment. Our choice, our opportunity. When is Mother going to give me opportunity? She's giving us an opportunity every minute. How big an opportunity? This big, that big? An infinite opportunity. But we have to stop seeing it as a finite and start relating to the infinite that's behind it. This, he says in this chapter later, he says, the Gnostic being will treat each material thing as divine. That's a wrong way of saying. Treating a thing as if divine, it's the Gnostic being will know that each material thing is divine. There's a difference, no? It's not a behavior. It will be conscious of the divinity in each thing. The Gnostic being will be conscious of the divinity in each person at each moment. It will relate to not the finite appearance of the person, it will relate to the infinite potential or spiritual soul of the person. In August 15th, 1972, was Sri Aurobindo's centenary. That was about 16 months before Mother left. There were about 10,000 sadhaks and devotees came to Pandi for Mother's darshan on August 15th that year. That was the biggest darshan I think there ever was when she was alive. And I remember standing, she was on the second floor balcony in the back, and the whole streets, as far as you could see in any direction, the streets were just completely packed with people. Somehow I managed to get somewhat under her in the main road right in front of the ashram on the seaside. And as she came out on the balcony, she looked down, and I was absolutely sure she's looking at me. And she's smiling at me. And it was such an incredible experience that she's personally blessing me. I felt it. It wasn't a thought. It was a concrete feeling. Mother is personally blessing me. There's 10,000 people here. As I was walking away after she went inside, I heard several people say, Mother was looking directly at me. Then I understood what I felt was true, but what they felt was also true. Appa says in the tradition, I don't know where it comes, in the tradition, a powerful yogi blesses one person at a time. In the tradition, the most greatest soul can bless seven people at a time. Here were 10,000 people. There, each of them not thinking, not imagining. Actually, she was relating to the soul of each person, to the truth in them, rather to the infinity in them, and bringing it to the surface. And we're all human beings, and we all have a well-defined finite surface. One of the most amazing things would be to see people who you knew pretty well, especially people who were not, let's just say, people you would like to relate to normally, they'll go to Mother on their birthday or for whatever occasion, and they come down looking totally like a different person. They'll be floating. There'll be something on their face which you have never seen. And certainly they've never expressed in relation to you. But Mother would bring that out of everybody. Of each person she saw, she would bring out not the finite in them, not something that they didn't even know was there, She related to what we are not conscious of in ourselves. She was conscious in us of the truth of our being, not the facade of finite which we think is ourselves. That's the Gnostic consciousness. Imagine she could do it with 10,000 at a time. You know, even to relate to one person harmoniously. And if you begin to see, if you begin to examine the thoughts we have, the reactions we have, why is this person telling me this? Don't they know I have something to do? Or they're bragging about this, or they're proud about this, or they're trying to say something about me, they think they know something. If you just watch the surface consciousness as we relate to one other person, can we even for 30 seconds or 3 minutes relate to the truth of another person from the truth of our being? Can we move from the surface to the truth of our own being, which is infinite, and relate from there to the truth of one other person? Then if we did that, we would have a tiny harmony in a sea of chaos or a sea of conflict. But if we're going to be an orchestra with 100 instruments, and each instrument is going to relate to the truth of its being in harmony with the truth of all the other 100, or million, or 10,000, and each one playing a different part, but each in harmony with the truth of the whole, the truth of all the other parts, and the truth that transcends the parts, which is the transcendent truth that's trying to express itself. This is the Gnostic life. This is the Gnostic consciousness. This is the divine life, where there'll be no rules, no rules, no morality. There'll be no discipline. You must do this, you must do that, you have to do, make pranam so many times, you have to say this mantra, you have to do this or that or anything. No rules at all. And yet everything will be in harmony with everything else, because we're not following a mental rule. Mind is an instrument of ignorance. Even if we're fully obedient to mind, we will still be in the ignorance, and usually in a lot of trouble, causing trouble for ourselves and other people, because it doesn't have the knowledge. With the best of intentions, we follow rules. We follow standards. Oh, he's not a good devotee. He's not doing the right thing that a devotee should do, as if there is a right thing that tells us who is a good devotee or not. As if we know the truth. If we don't know the truth of ourselves, how can we know the truth of anybody else? But we are very ready to assign all kinds of rules and arrange everybody in terms of categories, in terms of do they follow this rule or this rule? Is he a good person? Is he a bad person? And of course, all that was happening when Mother was here. And people used to be very angry with Mother. Mother, why are you meeting that person? He's a bad man. Mother is not related. Mother, that man is stealing from you. How can you be encouraging him like that? That man is lying to you. If Mother wants to have a place where only saints are, that's what Shrimana said. If I wanted to have a place where there are only saints, the ashram would be empty. But that we're here to bring out the truth that's buried in the ignorance. That's what he's talking about, the Gnostic consciousness. We're going to, I will stop in about 10 minutes, but I wanted to say that just so this doesn't sound as far away as the ape is from the human, as I read the chapter more and more, as we discussed it more and more on the calls every night and in our meeting, the more we discussed it, the more real it became, that this is what Appa's asking us to do at every minute. We all know. All I'm going to say is what you all know, but I'm trying to put it in a little different context. The method, the one method that they have given for us, we are blind in the ignorance, not knowing what the puzzle is, not knowing what the crystal is, not knowing what the symphony is, not knowing what the story is, and not knowing our part. But we have a light. We have a path. We have a way to do this. It's called self-consecration. At each moment, we have a light that can tell us how to move towards the truth of our being and everybody else's being. How do I know what to do in this situation? It's very difficult. That person comes and gives a proposal. He says something. He makes me angry or whatever it is. What do I know how to do? But he gives us a very clear guideline. Are you angry? Then you're in the falsehood. Are you excited? Then you're in the falsehood. Are you feeling superior to the other person? Then you're in the falsehood. Are you criticizing the other person? Then you're in the falsehood. What should you do? You should come out of the falsehood. If you don't know what the truth is, at least you can know what the falsehood is. And you can withdraw from it. You can withdraw from it, and you don't know what the truth is, so you take the falsehood and you offer it to Mother. And you say, not my will. Because my will is always the egoistic will, no matter how much I dress it up and how fancy I make it and I put flowers on it and burn incense around it and I give it a big name, Mother's Service and everything else. It is always the ego in some form or some disguise trying to become more important and trying to condemn and look down on other people. So the mantra is, not my will, thy will. If I don't know what the truth is, at least I can move away from the falsehood. I can stop insisting on the fact that I think my mind in the ignorance knows what's the true thing. I can offer the whole thing to you, which means I should be very calm. I should be very patient. I should feel peace. I should feel joy. I should feel gratitude to Mother for giving me an opportunity for a progress. I shouldn't feel superior to anybody. I shouldn't feel like abusing and accusing anybody. I should at every moment be asking myself, what is the progress that I can make? What is the progress, Mother, you want me to make at this minute? That is our movement at each minute from the human consciousness towards the Gnostic consciousness. And going back to what Vijaya said, that opportunity is there at each minute, not only in the big moments, not only in the big things. At each minute we have that opportunity to move on that path. So I found the more I thought about the chapter and what he's saying, the more practical it becomes. Because once we realize there is a truth, it's not a mental truth, it's not a formula, it's not a rule, it's not a behavior, it's not a ritual, it's not a habit, it's a vibration. It's a vibration of truth. At this moment, can I be in a vibration of truth? At least I can not stir up a vibration in the opposite direction of falsehood. That's why Mother says that if you're cheerful at every minute, if you're calm at every minute, if you're patient at every minute, if you have goodwill at every minute, if you're grateful at every minute, definitely you're because those are all divine qualities. Patience, peace, silence, gratitude, goodwill are the divine qualities. The Gnosis is a consciousness in which all these qualities are there at every minute. So I may not be able to get the million divine qualities and bring them together. Let me at least get one and cling to it. Vidya told me a story yesterday. She said a few years ago, I don't know when it was, she was having a cold in her head, and so she wanted to decongest her sinuses. So she was boiling water so she could lean over it and get the steam to go into her sinuses. And somehow the pot of boiling water spilled over onto her. At the same instant that the boiling, scalding water hit on her, she just didn't think or do anything. She just called Mother and rushed into Mother's arms. And for 2 minutes, she didn't even think to feel what's happening to her. And at the end of 2 minutes, when she looked down and saw the water all over her nightdress and everything, she found there was not a single burn on her body. Whereas Appa told a story of one of his relatives that happened to. The lady was in bed for a year because of it. So at each moment, we may not be able to get to the whole truth. At each moment, can we cling to one of those vibrations of truth or to Mother who is that embodiment of that? Yes?
Sir, I would like to know, if Darcy had access to all this information before he met Elizabeth, how his attitude would have been and how should he have behaved and how it will turn the events in the story.
You heard her. If Darcy had had this knowledge at the beginning when he was introduced to, say, he would have behaved the way Savitri behaved when she saw Satyavan coming out of the forest. Instead of calling her tolerable or seeing what class she's in or how pretty she is, he would have looked inside and seen the truth inside relating to the truth of her, which later happened to him. In fact, I can mention it again tomorrow, but it's a good point to end with. When Darcy came to Lambton Inn just after she's read the letter from Jane and found out about Lydia's elopement with Wickham, isn't this what Darcy did? Contrast it with what he did at Meryton. He didn't say, oh, this girl's sister has become a disgrace. She has run away with a rogue. The whole family is ruined. I better get out of here as quickly as possible before my reputation is sullied. I'm so glad that they didn't come for dinner tomorrow night because the whole family is ruined now. Too bad. Anyway, I'm lucky. I'm supposing I have proposed to her today and then Lydia's run away tomorrow. I'll be in big trouble. No, you can imagine how the mind will act. He didn't do any of that. He didn't think any of that. He didn't allow any. He didn't think, I told you so. I warned you about Wickham. You see, you should have listened to me. You see, I was right and you were wrong. He didn't put up any of the normal egoistic things. He quietly withdrew and she was sure she would never see him again. But actually, what did he do? He went into the depths of his being. And he said, I'm responsible for this. I must solve it. And his behavior in solving it comes as close as an analogy that I can think of for what the Gnostic consciousness is. It's an analogy, obviously, because the solution he came to was a solution for him that made his life radiantly happy, was a solution for Lizzie that saved her from the worst of things and gave her the highest thing she wanted. It was a solution for Mr. Bennett, for Mrs. Bennett, for Jane, for Bingley, for Wickham, for Lydia, even for the gardeners. It was a solution for everybody. It's not a win-lose game that I get and somebody else loses. He found that center of truth or harmony where if I do this, everybody gains. The best comes out of everybody. Everybody's element. That's the Gnostic consciousness. The Gnostic being can never hurt anybody because he acts from the center of truth of consciousness, which is the truth of everybody. because it's the divine truth. And in this story, it was not just the truth of the individuals, but as Appa has been emphasizing, it was the truth of social evolution. Darcy was not just coming to a solution for a few people. He was coming to the solution that helps the whole society evolve in consciousness. What was good for him was good for everybody else, was good for all. That's the Gnostic formula. Imagine if we could find, if we could know that truth, and if we could be sincere enough to act from that truth, to think that everything I do at every minute is good for all, and it's what Mother wants. It's my highest fulfillment, it's the highest fulfillment for everybody I relate to, and it's exactly, it's the fulfillment of what Mother and Sri Aurobindo were working for. That's